This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Conference 2021, held at Faith Builders from October 8 to 10.
Good morning. I'd like to tell you a personal story this morning about the hardest year of my teaching career. It was the 14th year. I don't know why it couldn't have been the 13th, but it was the 14th. And a lot of the difficulty of that year centered around a young lady who, in some ways, was one of the brightest students I've ever taught. She was a talented, articulate writer. She was a Chronicles of Narnia enthusiast, and she had this capacity for the quirky and the fanciful. Let me just give you an example. This is a math paper I once received from her. If you'll notice, there's some answers there, and then there's this little asterisk that says, more on back. So if there were four pages, actually, to this math document that she turned. It was lesson 93, I think. And so if you went to the fourth page, you got what you expected, this almost perfect, you know, mathematical calculations. I mean, it would make John Mark proud to have a student like this done so nicely. But what came on pages 2 and 3 were more of a metaphysical explanation of some of these math problems, at least some of that. And you see that here. And let's just zoom in a little bit. This was some question about people that were procrastinating. And she said 250 people believed that their difficulty was procrastination, but 400 people disagreed with them. Why does this word problem not give us more information? What do these people believe they are procrastinating? Is it something specific or everything in general? And why do the other 400 people disagree? Do they perhaps feel guilty and don't want to admit that they are procrastinators? Let's pretend that these people are procrastinating giving birthday cards. This effect this would have is far less dangerous than if they were procrastinating going to church or fixing a leak of carbon monoxide in the basement. While the carbon monoxide would cause a physical death, not going to church would cause lasting effects that could spiritually harm a person and their soul. Let's see, and to the next one. Perhaps these people are procrastinating giving their lives to Jesus. This will also have ill effects. It is dangerous to push off doing something like this because you may never have another chance. While it would appear that the 250 people who believe they're procrastinating are outnumbered by the 400, the problem is not whether more people agree with them, but whether they will do something about it now that they know that they are procrastinating. What an absolute delight. This dear student could be charming and helpful, kind and thoughtful, but, and just put that in capital letters, but she often chose otherwise. For mixed in with all her delight was a deeply, deeply troubled girl. From an early age, her life had had one trauma piled on top of another. Abuse at an early age, removal from her biological parents, an older sister who ran away, trust broken time and time again. And by the time she came to my classroom, she was going through this dark spiritual journey and probably dealing with mental health issues as well. She was lashing out in pain. She was mean to her classmates. She was moody. The way she would enter the classroom in the morning could just change the whole climate of the class. She was tricky to work with. She was the sort of person that when I'd start having a conversation with her, she could just shut down and refuse to talk to me. Sit in silence. And then later on, she'd go write an epistle, pages maybe, and slide it and pass it to me. She wanted to follow Jesus, but she couldn't quite surrender to him. She couldn't trust him. And to give you a flavor of her turmoil in our relationship, which I would consider a good relationship, here's just a piece of an email she sent me one time. She says, I don't know why you keep asking how you can help me when you know I'm going to tell you there's nothing you can do. You can't fix what's broken inside of me, and I know what you'll say. You'll tell me that only Jesus can do that. Ugh, I'm sick of people telling me that. If he's so great and powerful, why doesn't he do something? He leaves me stuck down here trying to figure out stuff on my own. While I'm wandering around blind, trying to figure out why I'm here and what I'm doing, he's standing off to the side, not even attempting to rescue me. I'm trying to piece together my heart, and he just keeps wounding me all over again, just like a man. Don't you love that last line? Even though she respected me, I think she loved me, and I cared for her, she was something of a terror to deal with. I would lay in bed in the mornings, wanting to stay curled up in a fetal position instead of going back to school that day. I never knew what the day would hold when she walked into that classroom. And day after day, this girl absorbed the grace that was offered her, not just by me, but by her classmates and others. And that grace came in many forms. It was the grace of cheerfully saying good morning to her morning after morning, even when she would walk into classroom in that dark and stormy mood. She soaked up the grace of the time I spent to try to figure out how to respond to her in her emails in redemptive ways. Sometimes she would write poems for me or stories that were dark and they had blood and evil. And then I had to figure out how to respond in gracious ways back to that sort of writing. The grace of taking the time to engage with her at the heart level and trying to help her find peace and joy and friendships, and the grace of walking beside her to try to seek restitution. And one time, after a particular mean-spirited sort of encounter, I suggested that she should write a letter to the girls in her classroom, sort of coming clean, admitting that she had been mean and that she hated it. And I told her, I said, look, you can read it to them, and I'll stand beside you while you read it. And later that day, she wrote me this. She said, Professor, that's what she liked to call me when she wrote to me, I thought a lot about your idea this afternoon. It's not a bad idea. I just feel uncomfortable about it. I have logical reasons, four of them exactly. Number one, my pride won't let me. I'm too embarrassed and ashamed of myself. Number two, God and I aren't currently on speaking terms, so it just doesn't feel fair for me to make promises I know I can't keep, since I know it's no use to try without Him. I mean, the girl was smart, you understand? Number three, I don't want to risk getting hurt again. Writing a letter like that would open myself up to the possibility of pain, and I'm not ready for that yet. I have a lot of wounds that aren't healed, and I don't want any more. Number four, this is a logical reason. Every time I've tried to write the letter today, I just end up crying. She was a vacuum cleaner, just sucking up all the grace that was sent her way. And for her, that grace was free. She didn't pay me to be kind. She didn't pay me to give her time and energy. She didn't pay her classmates. She didn't pay me for the time I invested in her. She experienced grace as a gift the same way we experience the grace of God. But for me and others in the school who were the grace givers, grace cost. That's the way grace is, isn't it? For the recipient, it's free. For the grace giver, it costs a lot. Like you, I've received a lot of grace in my life, much more than I deserve, and I have more to look forward to, but I've never paid a dime for it. The giver of that grace, however, has a different story. Grace cost him a whole lot. He gave up life in heaven, the beautiful concerts by angelic symphonies, the stimulating conversations with interesting characters like Moses and Miriam and Methuselah. And he came to earth and he had to submit to all those inconveniences of being humans. You know, things like getting the stomach bug and things like having a headache and stubbing your toe and getting those hated papyrus cuts, you know, on your finger. Just those little things that add up to the pain of being a human. And then he died that costly death. But it's not just that he died. He knew he was going to die. He knew how he was going to die. And he had to live tortured with knowing what was coming. It cost him a lot. Grace was costly for Jesus. Friday evening, we rejoice to survey God's amazing grace in our lives and how that could just overflow into our students' lives. And Saturday, Gerald explored with us how to teach gracefully so that our schools operate in alignment with the way God works with people, the way God works redemptively. And this morning, I want to end by counting the cost of passing along God's grace. What will it cost me as a teacher to be the sort of person who reaches out with grace to my students? And what I'd like to do is simply make a number of observations. So if you just come along with me, I'd like to make a few observations about the cost of grace. Now, be kind to me. Putting cost and grace together in a sentence is rather risky behavior. So let me clear myself a little here. We know grace is a gift. There is nothing we can do to earn the grace of God. Yet God is a gentleman. He doesn't force the fullness of His grace upon us. And Jesus Himself said that we should count the cost, or talked about counting the cost of following Him. And following Him is receiving His grace. And so if we want to experience receiving, notice this is not giving. If we want to enjoy the receiving, the experiencing of God's grace, and be the type of teacher we've talked about, I think it's okay to talk about counting the cost of receiving. Are y'all okay with this? So I'm not saying we earn it. I'm just saying that Jesus said, count the cost. What does it look like to be the sort of person who accepts, who receives grace? Experiencing grace means humbly admitting that we are needy, that we are poor in spirit. Peter, in his first letter, reminded us that God resists the proud. Can you finish it with me? But gives grace to who? To the humble. There are two authors, Robert Capon. If you haven't read Robert Capon, I suggest you do. He's a delightful mix of a theologian and a chef. And Philip Yancey have helped me think about the posture of neediness we need to receive grace. They've given me some language, so I owe this to them. Jesus showered His grace not on those who thought they had it all put together, but on those who knew that without Him, they were losers. Think of the stories that Jesus told about grace. How God searches for the lost coin and the lost sheep. How God cares for the least of these. How Jesus directed us to be like the little ones, the children. How grace came to the last ones in the parable we talked about on Friday. Grace is given to those of us who admit the truth, that we are the last ones, the least ones, the little ones, the lost ones, that without Him, we're losers. Am I, Patrick, willing to humble myself and say, I'm a loser, I'm a little one, I'm the least of them, I'm a lost one, without the grace of Jesus? If I'm not willing to say that, then I can't receive the fullness of the grace that Jesus has for me. We should also be willing to admit our neediness to each other, for He often uses others to dispense grace into our lives. Now, just a few practical ways to think about this posture of neediness. Tell God, tell Him in the morning that you need Him. Just admit it to God. Say, God, without you today, I can't do much. I need you. Maybe have a close circle of friends, a friend or two that you can confess your neediness to. Just tell them, I just really need God's grace today in this situation. Apologizing is a way to demonstrate our neediness. I once had a graceless junior high student. It felt like I could never measure up to her standards. I gave her a test or an assignment, and one time she'd complain because it was too easy, and sometimes she would complain because it was too hard. She would correct my pronunciation of a word. Like she was really prickly, and it made me trigger happy, metaphorically. One day we were out on the playground, and she did something, and I just jumped on her like that, called her out, and then I realized if any other student would have done that, I wouldn't have called him out. Yeah, so what did I do? After break, in the classroom, I said, you know, guys, I got after so-and-so out on the playground. And you know that, it wasn't fair. I shouldn't have done that, and I apologize. That is a demonstration to our students that we are needy, that we need grace. Now, a caution, I don't know that we need to stand in, actually, I know that we shouldn't stand in front of our classrooms and just tell them, I am so needy, I don't think I can teach y'all today. I'm just a poor, sorry teacher. If that's the truth, they'll find out anyhow. We don't need to announce our incompetence to the parents or to the students. I've seen that happen. It's dangerous. Tell God we need Him and then humbly step forward in His grace to serve to the best of your ability. But you can tell God and you can tell some close friends that you really need Him. Experiencing grace means a commitment to being a grace giver. Once we receive God's grace, He calls us to mimic His graceful behavior, to pass along His grace, and this is not optional. We see this point made in a story that Jesus told, a story about the importance of the grace of forgiveness, and I'd like to just take time to read that story. I'll make hardly any comments about it. Actually, I'll let it just stand on its own, and we'll read. The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, notice how graceless, law, accounting books. One was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that they had, and that payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience, be gracious with me, and I will pay you all. Then the master of the servant was moved with compassion, tore up the accounting books, released him, forgave the debt, grace. But that servant went out and found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, and he laid his hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, Pay me what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, Have patience with me, and I will pay you all. And he would not, but went and threw him into the prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what he had done, they were very grieved and came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, You wicked and graceless servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have had compassion and grace on your fellow servant just as I had on you? And his master was angry and delivered him to the torturers until he should pay all that was due to him. Notice the language there. So my heavenly Father will do to Patrick if he from his heart does not offer grace to his brother. Jesus said, For everyone to whom much is given, from him much will be required. You know, years ago I read the biography of Joe Kennedy, Sr., the patriarch of the Kennedy family. Joe Kennedy was a very wealthy businessman. He had connections in the halls of power of Washington, D.C. He was a politician. He had a large family. He was a very powerful man, not exactly a very holy man. But something he communicated to his children struck me, and I think it's in alignment with Jesus' teaching here. He told his children, you know, you've been given a lot. Now you need to give back. You owe that. You need to give back to your country. And so his children did. His eldest son, who was being groomed for the presidency, gave his life in World War II. His second oldest son, who we know as Jack, John F. Kennedy, almost gave his life in World War II, but then went to become the president and was assassinated. Another son was the Attorney General of the United States for John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, who, when running for president, was also assassinated and killed. Another one of the sons, Edward Kennedy, Ted, became a long-serving senator of the United States. Another one of the daughters founded the Special Olympics. Another daughter was the ambassador to Ireland. Now, understand with me, that energy was placed in an earthly kingdom, but there's a principle there. You've received a lot, now go serve. If we receive God's grace, there is an appropriate response. Pass that grace along. So as you consider whether you would like to receive God's grace, ask yourself these two questions. Am I willing to be needy? Am I willing to admit that I'm a loser without God's grace? And second of all, if I receive God's grace, part of counting the cost is saying, am I willing then to become like Jesus? Am I willing to pass that grace along? Let's pivot and let's talk about the cost of being a grace giver. Offering grace means sacrifice, a gifting of myself for another. We shouldn't be surprised, should we? Our model of grace ended up giving his own life as a sacrifice. So I'd just like to mention a few areas where we will be called to sacrifice. One is we must be willing to forgive and to forbear. We give up the right to hold grudges. God has given me practice with this. With a family in our school, I don't know how to calculate percentages, but probably a 90% of all the stress from any set of parents came from this one set of parents. There were complaints. There were areas where we did not live up to their standards. You know, we had an oven that we would turn on to slide hot food in for the kids when they bring lunches. It was set too hot. The kids' sandwiches would get burned. I didn't hear this from any other parent, but clearly we set the oven too high. Their daughter shouldn't be playing basketball, so they'll just come early before school lets out, before PE time, and just take her home because she can't participate in basketball. And we don't like that our son has to read Shakespeare. That's an evil book. We're not going to read that. And there's this other book over here. And no other parent ever complained to me, I don't think, about any reading we did in school. But there was concern about that. And through these interactions with this set of parents, I learned a new skill. I've given it a name. It's the skill of creating an alternative narrative in my mind. See, the narrative that wants to play is that I can think of all the motives and the feelings they must have and all these things, and I can paint this picture of why these people are acting in this way towards me. But what I have to do is I have to forbear. I have to say, oh, you know what? They're probably having a really hard time right now. And you know, I bet they read something or watched something when they were in school that really influenced them in certain ways. And I force myself to create a new storyline, a new plot in my mind to give them grace. And you see, this family's life really was a struggle. The father was addicted to pain medicines. There was domestic violence. There was financial stress. And my job in giving grace was to sacrifice the feelings that wanted to come up inside of me and instead forgive and forbear. We sacrifice through acts of kindness and service, picking up the trash we see on the floor and opening doors and smiling at students and saying please and thank you to our students, being servants. You know, do you ever find that it's hard to sacrifice and to offer grace? Because our students sometimes, they really do seem rebellious or lazy or grumpy. And I don't know, those people like that just kind of make you angry and want to be grumpy in return, and it's hard to sacrifice. And so I think there's something we need to remember. Have you ever been lost? Like truly lost? Of course, in today, the day of GPS, I don't know whether people get lost anymore. But I once took a high school class to Washington, D.C. This was before the days when everybody carried cell phones. And there was one guy in the class. I mean, if there ever was a guy that was self-sufficient, tough dude, it was him. And we got there, and the first night I took them out onto the mall, rode the subway, the metro out to the mall, and we got out of the metro stop, and we're looking around, and I'm probably lecturing them on the religion of the United States government, and look at the temples around you, and think about how great heaven will be if man can build buildings like this, think of what God can build, and all those things. And then he said, you know, he said, man, if I got lost and just like left here and y'all went away, he said, I wouldn't know what to do. I'd just have to sit on a bench. It was great, this big, tough guy just saying, I'd be completely lost in the city. I don't know what I would do. If you ever lost, there's that panic and that fear. Do you know that your students are lost? And when you think they're grumpy and angry and moody and rebellious, if we can remember that they're lost, it helps us sacrifice for them and extend grace. For some reason, lostness allows me to be more compassionate than rebellious. But when my student is rebellious, they're actually lost. And I can be a part of helping God find them. Offering grace means embracing patience. Grace is patient. It does not use force to accomplish its work. It doesn't always resort to big guns, rewards, punishments to get instant results. Instead, it takes the long road of walking beside another person, of growing them. Did you ever notice that about God in the Bible? God grows things. I mean, we notice it in nature. God starts with an acorn, and he doesn't snap his fingers, and we get a massive oak tree. It takes a long time because that's just the way God has designed the universe. He's designed it as a growing universe, and he does the same with people. How about Moses? God takes Moses, and then Moses kind of drops out of the storyline for a long time. For what, 40 years? And God grows him. God's patient. He's got time. And he grows Moses for a long time. How about Paul? We meet Paul, he becomes a Christian, and then we start reading the Bible and we notice that Paul actually kind of drops off the scene for years. God grows things. And God does the same thing today. Someone once said that the best tool we have at our disposal is just simply time. Did you know that 15-year-olds actually do become 35 years old? God grows things. Like, it takes time. Remember the story Gerald told yesterday about him walking with this lady who pulled the child out of school and all of that? Gerald took his time. He didn't force things. He let the storyline play out, and Gerald told me this morning that he had a meeting with that mother last night. The child is coming back to school, and she was repentant and talked about how terrible of a person she was and how sorry she was for all the things she was doing. If Gerald would have been led with his fist instead of with patience, that would have never happened. Grace is slow. It's patient. It doesn't force itself. One of the people with outsized influence in my home church is a young man who, when he was in my classroom, was rough, probably a little cocky. I don't know that anyone saw all the potential that was in this young man. I remember one day we were having cleaning time on Friday afternoon, and the rule in our school was you had to have your shirt tail tucked in. And he didn't have his shirt tail tucked in, and so I said, "Hey, sir, you need to get your shirt tail tucked in." And instead, he was done with his job. He just exited out the side of the building and went around the front. So he didn't submit. He just exited. So I exited, too, out the front of the building, and we ran into each other, and we had words. But you see, he was tender to God, and he wrote me an email that afternoon and apologized and thanked me for confronting him. They're not all like this, by the way. But God sanded this young man, and he ran him through the planer, and he polished him. And you know, that young man is incredibly influential at my church today. I don't know, he's maybe in his 20s. He has invested himself in the children and young people. He teaches Sunday school class, and then he takes those students on a Saturday to a hunting show in the capital city. He and his wife take them, and he calls me up and wants to know whether my sons would like to go hunting because I don't hunt. And he takes my sons hunting. But he doesn't just take my sons hunting. He takes my nephew hunting. And he takes the other little kid in the church hunting. And he pays attention to them. And he builds relationships with older people. And when it was time for me to turn over the kids club that we had at our church, he's the person that I mentored and apprenticed. And then he took over the kids club. And he's not ordained. And he's just a normal guy. But he holds tremendous power in his hands. Just last weekend, we drove from Miami to South Carolina, and I got a text from him, and he said, "Hey, do Isaiah and Ariel want to go hunting on Friday night?" And my daughter just got baptized, and We throw parties after baptisms. That's the tradition in my house. I think baptisms are worth having parties over, and so we had a party after it, baptism. And who did my 15-year-old daughter invite? She invited that guy. That happened, you know, was a Sunday school teacher of hers and who she would go and babysit for. God took this boy who was kind of cocky and rough, and because he was tender and because there was grace in his life over time, he's become someone beautiful. We are called to settle in to giving grace for the long haul. The last one. Offering grace means being different. I am struck and saddened by all the ungrace I see online posted by Christians in Anabaptist churches. It's as if the quiet in the land have decided to join the rest of the world in becoming the mouthy in the land. And I contrast all those complaints and harangues we hear about public people with the almost indifference we see in the New Testament to what was going on in the Roman Empire. Jesus, Paul, and the others were so focused on God's grace and His work in the world that the politics of the Roman Empire were just like a blip on the screen. Now, I lay in bed last night thinking about what's going on in our world. I hope there is an off-ramp to the escalating verbal war in our society. But if there isn't, if this just continues, we will have a tremendous opportunity as Anabaptists to be salt and light in the world if we reject the loud, the punchy, the snide, and the bomb-throwing and embrace the gentle, the patient, and loving grace. Teachers, this is personal. I plead with you. Sacrifice the pleasure of getting in the mix, in the ring, and be different. Model grace to your students. Show them a different way, a way that's like cool water poured out in a burned out land. This is our moment of opportunity. Let us not waste it. We should be the people that are bringing grace. We should be modeling that to our students. You see, our classrooms can be toxic places. It's the place where the children in our communities come together and discuss the issues they hear about at home. And if we join in that, if we throw our weight one side or the other, if we practice ungrace and we don't bring gentleness and love, then we are modeling and training a generation of young people that are no different than the generation of people in our society who practice ungrace. And we will have wasted the opportunity we have to be a shining light in our world. If we live gracefully, however, we will stick out. We may be considered old-fashioned because grace doesn't throw a fit at every latest headline. Grace does not run people down, make fun of them on social media. Grace calms flames instead of fanning them. Grace means we're very cautious about jumping on sides in discussions about politics in our classrooms because grace builds bridges and wins others. Grace does not demonize them. And we will model the golden rule to our students, even in our behaviors to people who are not present, both people in the past who are not present because they're in the graveyard and people who are alive today but in other parts of the world. Grace is filled with goodwill. Grace is filled with compassion and a willingness to give others the benefit of the doubt. I don't care what political party they're a part of. They deserve the golden rule. Will we be grace-filled teachers? You will be different. Some days, they're going to think you're a Republican. Some days, they're going to think you're a Democrat. You're going to pray the Lord's blessing on President Biden. You're going to pray the Lord's breast blessing on former President Trump. You're going to be so loving and kind, they don't know what universe you came from. and you say, I've met the man who gave his life for all of us. Please, folks, let's be different. Let's be graceful. So why do we do all of this? Why do we go through all this cost? We don't do it because it guarantees fast results. You know that young lady that I told you about? She tanked. For a while, she ended up in a mental hospital, and that was grace in her life. She left school. She was in and out of her home. She made bad choices. But you know, some things are hopeful. Here recently, I saw her attending church with her fiancé, and don't you know they got married the other week? Yo, that's huge. When she was in my classroom and later, you would have known where she would have ended up in. She could have been in prison. She could have been dead by now. Seems like her life is mending. You know, there are a lot of people that offer grace in her life. It wasn't just me. We'll see where it leads to. God grows things. But we don't do this because it just guarantees results immediately. You know, I think we live lives of grace because as we experience God's grace, we become like Him. There's a sense in which we can't help it. Like, if we truly are children of God, then we become like Him, and if He's full of grace, then we become full of grace. It's the way it's going to be. That's the way He's forming us. Ephesians 2:10, for we are God's handiwork, prepared in Christ Jesus for good works. He made us to be this way. He is making us this way. And so when somebody says, why are you such a grace-filled teacher? You say, well, I hang out with God, and He's full of grace, and He lives in me, and I live with Him, and it's a byproduct. It's not, yeah, we have to work on it, but He's doing it. And we're grace-filled because that's who we are. That's who we're becoming. You know, we practice grace because we get to participate in the great work of changing lives. Paul said, I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to all who believe. And salvation works through grace, and we get to receive that grace, and we get to participate with God and be involved in the most powerful force for change in the world. Forget what you read in the newspaper. There is no army on earth. There is no economic system on earth. There is no political leader on earth that can change people's lives. And we get to be involved in that work. And so we're involved in grace, and we share grace, and we experience grace because we get to be involved in changing lives. Grace is the God-designed mystery of the universe. It's the holy key to break the lock of evil in the world. Grace, sacrificial, costly grace, breaks the curse of sin. Grace is God dying as a gift to bring life to us. It's my dying to self to accept that gift. It's me dying, sacrificing for others to pass that love along. It's holy, it's mysterious, it's powerful, but it's the only way from death to life. It's how God works His will on the earth as it is in heaven. I don't understand everything about grace. Why is it that dying brings life? Why is it that sacrifice cuts against the grain of evil and self-will in the world? But it's the mystery. It's the way God has designed the earth. Folks, we stand in the Mississippi. We are surrounded by God's vast resource of grace. It's swirling all around us every day. We can never give away more than what's coming. And God is just inviting us to take all this grace that's swirling all around us and then to dip our cups into His abundant grace and little by little pour it out into the lives of our students. It will bring refreshment. It will bring the best shot at life change that we can give. It will buoy us up, and it will bring blessing to the world. Our little cups will never drain the Mississippi River, but we get to participate in watering the earth with God's grace.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.